Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for May's Orthopaedic Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce you to our speaker for today, RCVS Recognised Specialist in Small Animal Surgery Orthopaedics, Duncan Barnes. Thank you, Duncan. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Hello, and welcome to this webinar in which we will be looking at the uses of computed tomography in veterinary orthopaedics. I'll briefly go through how CT works and then look at the ways in which we use CT in practice. These include the diagnosis of orthopaedic disease, the planning of orthopaedic procedures, for the creation of three-dimensional models of bones and implants for surgical rehearsal, and finally, as a research tool. So, this webinar is about CT from the perspective of an orthopaedic surgeon. However, I find that we get the best results when we work with a radiologist. It is great when the radiologist is present in-house, but with the growth of teleradiology in recent years, it is straightforward to send images to a radiologist working remotely for interpretation. Radiologists can help us to improve the quality of our imaging. They can look at the images with a fresh and potentially less biased perspective and spot lesions which may not always be obvious to the surgeon. However, I think it's important that the surgeon always looks at the images themselves as well. This helps to improve the surgeon's appreciation of the anatomy of the individual animal, and sometimes we detect lesions not noted by the radiologist and often make specific measurements not routinely performed by the radiologist. So, what is CT? Here we see the donut-shaped gantry of a CT scanner. The animal lies on the table, which is moved slowly through the centre of the gantry as the X-ray beam passes through the patient. Underneath the shell of the gantry, we find an X-ray head, which emits X-rays on one side of the gantry, whilst they are detected on the opposite side by a number of rows of detectors. The number of rows determines the number of slices the scanner has. The X-ray head and X-ray detectors spin around the patient as the patient passes through the centre of the gantry, and depending on the radio density of the anatomical structures being imaged, the X-ray beam is more or less attenuated. The computer is then able to build up a three-dimensional picture of the body using this density information. Similar to a standard radiograph, structures of increasing radio density are depicted with increasing whiteness on a grayscale. The picture on the right of an extruded intervertebral disc within the spinal canal of a dog shows the range of tissues densities that can be seen. The gas within the stomach appears black, fat appears dark gray, soft tissues appear mid-gray, with contrast in the aorta and mineralized disc material appearing bright gray. The bone appears white. Hemorrhage can often be identified as a radio density slightly greater than soft tissue as a result of the iron content of hemoglobin, and this is useful in the diagnosis of subdural hematomas following head injury. Metal has a radio density greater than bone. Stainless steel and cobalt chrome are so radio dense that they prevent X-rays passing through, leading to marked imaging artifacts on CT. Titanium alloys, however, cause significantly less artifact, making the use of titanium implants very useful where postoperative CT is likely to be needed. The computer will then assign a radiographic density to each unit of volume, or voxel, within the part scanned. A voxel is the three-dimensional version of a pixel. The radio density is measured in Hounsfield units and can be used to determine the probable composition of a region of interest. Water has a Hounsfield unit of 0, whilst that of air is about minus 1,000. Cortical bone has a Hounsfield unit of around 1,500 to 3,000, depending on how dense it is. The computer is able to recombine the raw data using different algorithms to help enhance the appearance of different types of tissue. For example, three of the most commonly used are soft tissue, bone, and lung algorithms. Soft tissue algorithms enhance the ability to differentiate between tissues of subtly different radio density, whilst reducing noise. Bone and lung algorithms tend to enhance edges between tissues of markedly different radio densities, helping to visualize fine cortical detail within bone or lung parenchyma. For most orthopedic applications, both soft tissue and bone algorithms are used to look at the region of interest, optimizing the appearance of each of these tissue types. It's very important to view the different algorithms with the appropriate viewing window. All of these images are based on the same raw scan data. The blue lined images, going diagonally across the middle, show how the image quality for viewing different tissue types is optimized by choosing the correct combination of algorithm and viewing window. It can be seen that the viewing window makes a large difference to the appearance of the images, whilst the use of a different algorithm is a more subtle change. Changing the window width will alter the range of radio densities over which the grayscale is distributed. A narrow window is needed to distinguish tissues of similar density. For example, in a soft tissue window, the window width is around 400. On the other hand, when viewing bone and lung images, where tissues of greatly differing densities are close together, a wide viewing window is necessary to create a sharp image. The window level determines the Hounsfield unit or radio density that the grayscale is centered on. For a bone window, the level is set high to allow imaging of tissues from soft tissue right up to cortical bone, whereas a lung window level is lower to optimize the imaging of gas and soft tissue interfaces. When a soft tissue window is used, bone will appear very bright with a lack of internal detail and a flare around it, resulting in an indistinct boundary. This is because the radio density of bone is well beyond the upper limit of the grayscale used in a soft tissue window. Contrast agents are used routinely in CT and much more commonly than during radiography. Most commonly, the contrast agent is given via the intravenous route, but it may also be used intraarticularly for CT arthrography, or it may be injected into the subarachnoid space during CT myelography. Intravenous contrast will highlight vessels and tissues with high or increased vascularity, such as inflamed or neoplastic tissues. Intravenous contrast can also delineate non-vascular tissues such as accumulations of pus, joint fluid, necrotic tissue, and cysts, which tend to have a rim of contrast-enhancing tissue surrounding them. In the case shown here, a large abscess is seen within the right iliopsoas muscle. The pus is seen as hypodense compared to the surrounding tissue, with a contrast-enhancing rim of soft tissue surrounding it. A migrating foreign body was suspected, and degraded plant material was found at the time of surgery. Intra-articular contrast can be used to distinguish between the articular cartilage and the joint fluid, which have similar radio density on non-contrast CT. In this sagittal image of a dog with osteochondritis discans, the intra-articular contrast can be seen between the flap of cartilage and the subchondral bone of the caudal humerus, as indicated by the red arrow. Mass lesions and joint mice can also be highlighted as filling defects during CT arthrography. Techniques for the identification of meniscal tears using intra-articular contrast have been described, but tend to be limited in their clinical utility by relatively low sensitivity. When injecting contrast into the joint, it is important to dilute the contrast agent to reduce flare around the contrast and create a crisp image. Dilution with a long-acting local anesthetic agent, such as bupivacaine, is useful preoperatively or to allow diagnostic analgesia of a joint. As with any intra-articular injection, it's important to perform the injection using strict aseptic technique. CT has a number of advantages over conventional radiography. A major advantage of CT is improved contrast resolution, though spatial resolution is actually less good for thin structures such as the toes. The greatest advantage of CT over radiography is the elimination of the superimposition of anatomical structures. This is most evident in anatomically complex areas such as the carpi, tarsi, skull, and spine. The X-ray and equivalent CT images shown in this slide are from a Jack Russell Terrier who presented with a left hind limb lameness and paresis. The clinical examination led to a neurolocalization to a left-sided L5-S3 lesion, but radiographs revealed no abnormalities. However, a CT revealed a contrast-enhancing lesion of the L6 nerve root. This is seen originating within the spinal canal and extending through the left L6-7 intervertebral foramen. A further advantage of CT over radiography is that a CT scan is generally quicker to perform than multiple radiographic views, with less repositioning of the patient needed. However, the larger amount of information generated means that CT scans take longer to interpret than radiographs. Overall, CT has a greater sensitivity for the detection of lesions and greatly increases the confidence of the surgeon in the diagnosis of orthopaedic disease. There are many situations where CT allows the definitive diagnosis of a primary disease process, where it is only possible to infer the presence of disease due to secondary changes using radiography. This is exemplified by the diagnosis of medial coronoid disease, discussed in more depth later in this seminar. Naturally, CT has some disadvantages. It's generally more expensive than radiography, and where an adequate diagnosis can be made with radiographs alone, this is usually preferable. Its sensitivity can sometimes be problematic, since often multiple lesions are found, whilst not all are of clinical significance. It is therefore important that the clinician interpret the results of the CT scan in the light of the clinical history and examination findings to determine which lesions are clinically significant. The images shown here are both from a middle-aged overweight Labrador. The 3D reconstruction of the left shoulder on the left shows the presence of mineralizing tendinopathy of the supraspinatus tendon. The image on the right is a transverse image through the medial coronoid process of the left elbow and reveals medial coronoid disease. By putting these findings together with the clinical history and examination, it was determined that the elbow lesion was the clinically significant one and the cause of the observed lameness, whilst the shoulder lesion was an incidental finding. Further disadvantages of CT compared to radiography include rare adverse reactions to the intravenous contrast agent used and an increased exposure to ionizing radiation. We will now look in more depth at some of the ways in which we use CT in the diagnosis of orthopaedic disease. CT offers a major advantage over radiography during the investigation and diagnosis of elbow dysplasia. Elbow dysplasia is a common and complex group of diseases with a number of variations. The term elbow dysplasia refers to a group of primary developmental abnormality of the elbow joint, which includes medial coronoid disease, ununited anconeal process, osteochondritis discans of the medial aspect of the humeral condyle, and elbow incongruency. These may be seen individually or in combination. Medial coronoid disease is the most common component of elbow dysplasia. With traditional radiography, it's rare to directly visualize medial coronoid disease, and the clinician is reliant on secondary changes such as subtrochlear sclerosis, seen here, or the presence of osteophyte formation on the proximal aspect of the anconeal process, and on the radial head, as seen here. These changes are often very subtle, their interpretation rather subjective, and the clinician is reliant on good radiographic technique to allow a diagnosis to be made. However, CT allows the primary abnormality to be diagnosed, and a range of specific types of medial coronoid abnormalities can be appreciated. Here we see a hypodense medial coronoid process. Just get an arrow up. There we go. This one's hypodense. We can see a fissured medial coronoid process with an undisplaced fragment. This one is a displaced medial coronoid process fragment. And this one's an abnormally shaped medial coronoid process. All of these changes represent medial coronoid disease, but the specific treatment recommended will vary depending on the type of disease and the stage at which it's diagnosed. Arthroscopic debridement is commonly used to allow removal of osteochondral fragments and debridement of the abnormal medial coronoid process. The CT findings can be very helpful to guide the surgeon performing arthroscopy by providing information about the location and depth of lesions. This is especially useful where the changes are confined to the bone and the overlying articular cartilage is grossly normal in appearance during arthroscopy. It was found by Moores et al. That CT and arthroscopy were complementary to each other, with different aspects of elbow dysplasia appreciated with each modality. I find that performing an elbow CT prior to surgery allows me to be much more confident when performing arthroscopy about the extent of debridement needed. My experience is that it is rare to have CT normal elbows with changes found at arthroscopy. The transverse CT image and arthroscopic photograph shown here are from a 9-month-old Labrador with a moderate forelimb lameness. The subtle hypodensity of the medial coronoid process on CT was found to be an undisplaced fragment during probing at arthroscopy. Performing CT postoperatively can also be useful during the surgeon's learning curve to confirm how much bone has been removed during arthroscopy, and it is often considerably less than would be anticipated. The second manifestation of elbow dysplasia, osteochondrosis, can be detected using radiography or CT as a defect in the contour of the subchondral bone. However, CT provides us with much more information, including the size of the defect, its exact position, and whether the cartilage has formed a flap, and whether the flap is partially attached or detached. It can also allow the definitive diagnosis of concomitant medial coronoid disease. These findings are important since they provide information about the prognosis and guide treatment selection. This frontal plane image of a 6-month-old Labrador shows osteochondritis discans of the medial part of the humeral condyle. In this case, there is mineralization of the flap and sclerosis of the humerus surrounding the lesion, making contrast arthrography unnecessary. Not all osteochondrosis lesions are clinically significant, and this is an excellent indication for contrast arthrography to distinguish between osteochondrosis manifesta, which is not significant, and osteochondritis discan lesions, which usually are. Osteochondrosis manifesta lesions are radiographically visible but are usually clinically insignificant because the region of thickened cartilage is well adhered to the underlying bone. This sagittal image of a CT arthrogram is from the asymptomatic left shoulder of a dog with OCD of the right shoulder. It shows a typical osteochondrosis manifesta lesion. The contrast agent does not get between the thickened cartilage and bone, and the contour of the articular surface is unaffected. A bubble of gas from the arthrogram is also visible in the cranial joint compartment. Osteochondritis discans lesions generally cause clinical signs when the flap is partially detached, allowing inflammatory mediators from the necrotic subchondral bone access to the joint, causing synovitis and pain. This frontal plane image of the right elbow is from a 5-month-old golden retriever with a 3 out of 5 right forelimb lameness. A contrast arthrogram has been performed, and a contrast can be seen dissecting between the flap of cartilage and the bone. In this case of shoulder osteochondritis discans, the flap has already detached. The contrast is seen to abut the subchondral bone with no cartilage flap in between. The detached flap might be identifiable within the joint as a joint mouse creating a filling defect within the joint space. In many dogs where the flap has been detached, it will come to lodge in the caudal joint pouch, where it may cause no further problems, and so surgery might not be necessary if the dog is asymptomatic at this stage. If it is lodged in the biceps tendon sheath or between the joint surfaces, it is more likely to cause clinical signs and require removal. By locating the flap preoperatively, a more directed approach to removal can be performed. Elbow incongruency is notoriously difficult to assess radiographically due to the complex three-dimensional shape of the elbow. CT allows the presence, type, and magnitude of elbow incongruency to be assessed. Elbow incongruency can be either radio ulnar, humeral ulnar, or a combination of both. Radio ulnar incongruency is evident as a step between the radius and ulna at the level of the coronoid process, and may result from a short radius or a short ulna. A small amount of incongruency is considered normal, whilst up to 2 mm is mild, more than 4 mm is severe. The images show sagittal images of elbows with normal congruency, mild radio ulnar incongruency, moderate radio ulnar incongruency, and severe radio ulnar incongruency. In cases with severe radio ulnar incongruency, there is almost always humeral ulnar incongruency in addition, since the humerus subluxates from the trochlear notch of the ulna. Humeral ulnar incongruency occurs when the humeral condyle appears to have a poor fit in the trochlear notch of the ulna. This can be associated with other problems such as medial coronoid disease and ununited anconeal process, as seen in these sagittal images of the left and right elbows of a six-month-old German Shepherd dog. In the left elbow, humeral ulnar incongruency is evident with increased subchondral bone density at the cranial base of the anconeal process around the trochlear notch of the ulna. In the right elbow, the same radio density can be seen in the ulnar trochlear notch adjacent to an ununited anconeal process. It is thought that this increased strain on the anconeal process due to humeral ulnar incongruency is important in the pathogenesis of some cases of ununited anconeal process. When faced with a complex fracture, such as this acetabular fracture in a cat, CT can be extremely helpful. CT viewing software can display the images in a number of different ways. The standard way is to look at the individual axial slices as two-dimensional images. However, studies by Steiger-Venegas et al. 2015 have shown that optimum assessment of pelvic fractures is obtained when a combination of three-dimensional volume rendering, as shown here, and the assessment of multiplanar reconstructions, as shown here, gives the best results and is suited to the assessment of different aspects of the fracture. Multiplanar reconstructions display the imaging data as three orthogonal planes. These can be manipulated to reposition the imaging plane and allow a very accurate assessment of the fracture to be made. CT can help establish if the fracture involves the joint or sacrum, which is often very difficult to establish definitively from radiographs. This can help determine whether surgical repair is feasible or salvage surgery from the outset would be a better option. If repair is to be attempted, the appreciation gained through visualization of the fragment distribution improves planning of the approach to the fracture and often facilitates a much less invasive approach. In this case, repair was feasible, and here we see the repair which was achieved, and the resultant healing 6 weeks later. The implants used in this case were titanium alloy, allowing the postoperative CT scan to be performed with minimal artifact and an assessment of the accuracy of reduction of the acetabular fracture to be made. A number of orthopaedic conditions are characterized by the mineralization of soft tissues. The superior contrast resolution and the ability to localize these tissues in three dimensions make CT more useful than radiography for the assessment of these lesions. For example, CT with or without CT myelography is excellent for the diagnosis of intervertebral disc disease. Mineralized intervertebral disc material can be easily localized and lateralized using plain CT. The addition of CT myelogram can help to determine the degree of spinal cord compression where there are multiple lesions or the lesion is not mineralized. Establishing the correct site and side is critical to the success of decompressive surgeries such as hemilaminectomy. For other types of spinal lesions and for prognosis in cases of suspected myelomalacia, MRI is considered to be the gold standard for diagnosis. The ability to generate three-dimensional volume rendering of the spine can help the surgeon to visualize the approach necessary, and CT can be used to assess the completeness of disc material removal postoperatively. Mineralized tissues such as tendons and ligaments are often visible on radiography. However, due to the superimposition of structures, it can be difficult to establish the exact location and significance of such mineralized structures. CT allows precise localization to be achieved, as demonstrated in a 7-year-old Rottweiler with flexor enthesiopathy of the humeral head of the flexor carpi ulnaris muscle. This condition is considered to be the result of chronic overuse and damage to the flexor carpi ulnaris tendons. It can also be seen secondary to medial coronoid disease, and so CT is especially important to determine whether the condition is primary or secondary, since the treatment approach is somewhat different. This image shows the similar condition of medial epicondylitis in a cat. There is again mineralization within the tendon of origin and proximal muscle belly of the flexor carpi ulnaris muscle. The mineralized tissue often leads to impingement upon and dysfunction of the ulnar nerve, leading to chronic lameness. Three-dimensional imaging helps to establish whether the mineralized tissue is likely to be impinging on the nerve and guides the surgeon to the location of the mineralized tissue during surgical removal of the affected tissue and release of the ulnar nerve. This is a transverse CT image through both shoulders of a 10-year-old greyhound with right shoulder pain on palpation on the biceps groove. The red arrow is pointing towards mineralization of the supraspinatus tendon of insertion, where it inserts on the greater tubercle of the humerus. In the majority of dogs with supraspinatus tendinopathy, mineralization is considered to be an incidental finding of minimal clinical significance. In this dog, it is evident that the mineralization of the supraspinatus tendon on the right is causing impingement and irritation of the tendon of origin of the biceps brachii. We will commonly perform diagnostic ultrasound in addition to CT to assess the structural integrity of the biceps tendon. In this case, resection of the mineralized portion of the supraspinatus tendon was successful in resolving the lameness. In the next section of the webinar, we will look at, in a bit more depth at the ways that we use contrast agents to help us diagnose orthopedic conditions with CT. Intravenous contrast is given during most CT examinations to help highlight areas of increased vascularity. This is useful during the diagnosis and staging of neoplastic disease. This 9-year-old lurcher was presented with a 3-week history of progressive left hind limb lameness and firm, painful swelling of the distal half of the tibia. The radiograph on the left is diagnostic of an aggressive bone lesion with spiculated and palisading periosteal new bone formation, permeative erosion of the cortical bone, cortical thinning, a Cobman's triangle at the margin of the tumour due to lifting of the periosteum, and a gradual zone of transition between normal and abnormal bone. However, the CT scan image on the right of the same dog allows a better appreciation of the extent of the tumour infiltration, especially important where limb-sparing surgery is being contemplated. It can also reveal regions of cortical thinning where it may be possible to get a diagnosis by fine needle aspirate. Synovial neoplasms can be diagnosed more easily with CT, such as this histiocytic sarcoma seen in the stifle of a large crossbreed dog. These lesions can be easily missed on routine radiography. The radiographs of this dog stifle revealed a stifle effusion, mild degenerative joint disease, and soft tissue swelling. He was initially referred for the treatment of cranial cruciate ligament rupture. However, a subtle reduction in the radiodensity of the medial femoral condyle on radiographs suggested a CT examination was indicated, and this revealed diffuse contrast enhancement within the joint capsule and lysis of the medial femoral condyle within the intercondylar notch. Contrast CT was helpful in the diagnosis of this nerve sheath tumour within the brachial plexus of a 5-year-old Labrador with left forelimb lameness and a normal neurological examination. While CT can detect a high proportion of cases, MRI is considered to be the gold standard for the detection of subtle nerve changes and is superior to CT in determining the proximal extension of nerve sheath tumours into the spinal canal. Extension into the spinal canal can markedly affect the prognosis for these patients. The dog in this case had bilateral elbow dysplasia in addition, which was originally suspected to be the cause of his forelimb lameness. This illustrates the reason why we will include a contrast series of the brachial plexus in all dogs having forelimb lameness investigations. Here we see contrast enhancement of a soft tissue sarcoma originating within the subscapularis muscle of the shoulder of a flat coat retriever. The CT can be used to guide the selection of suitable sections of the mass to biopsy, avoiding regions of necrosis, blood vessels, and choosing the most superficial location that would be easily included in any definitive surgical plan. The location, direction, angle, and depth of insertion of a TrueCut biopsy needle can all be determined from the CT, and where the lesion is smaller than this one, the CT can be repeated with the needle in place prior to biopsy to ensure that it is correctly located. Sometimes natural contrast between the fat of a lipoma and the structure surrounding it allows the extent and behavior of the tumor to be determined. This infiltrative lipoma was discovered within the caudal thigh of a 60-year-old husky with hind limb swelling and mechanical lameness. The lipoma could be seen enveloping the sciatic nerve and infiltrating between the muscle fibers of the semitendinosus muscle. It was therefore evident that the local resection was not possible and amputation of the limb was necessary. The histiocytic sarcoma of the stifle of this 5-year-old Rottweiler was a bit less subtle than the previous example of a stifle histiocytic sarcoma. CT was useful during the staging of disease in this case. It revealed both the local extent of the tumour and the presence of enlargement and enhancement of the draining medial iliac lymph node indicated by the arrow. CT is extremely sensitive for the detection of pulmonary and bone metastases in dogs with osteosarcoma and other types of musculoskeletal neoplasia. The ability to rapidly scan the entire body is a major advantage of CT. However, most of the data in the literature regarding the prognostic implications of metastases relates to the radiographic and ultrasounding findings. This should be taken into account when considering the significance of very small suspected metastases on CT, which may not progress to radiographic detectability for some time. Many contrast-enhancing lesions are not neoplastic, and intravenous contrast agents are also very useful when assessing inflamed and infected tissues. Here, intravenous contrast is highlighting the inflamed and infected joint capsule in this 5-year-old labradoodle with septic arthritis of the shoulder joint. The excessive accumulation of hyperdense joint fluid is visible within the joint, and there is early erosion of the periarticular bone of the greater tubercle. These erosions were more evident on the series using a bone algorithm. Intravenous contrast can highlight regions of inflamed muscle or tendon. This 7-year-old working border collie had a moderate right hind limb lameness and pain on palpation of the lateral fibella region and was referred for the treatment of suspected cranial cruciate ligament disease. In these axial and sagittal images of the right stifle, there is contrast enhancement of the tendon of origin and proximal belly of the lateral head of the gastrocnemius muscle. A mild stifle joint effusion is also evident, since the joint capsule extends around the fibula and gastrocnemius tendons. These changes were diagnostic of tendinopathy and myopathy of the lateral head of the gastrocnemius muscle in this dog. No evidence of cranial cruciate ligament disease was found, and the condition was successfully treated with conservative treatment and therapeutic ultrasound. The final section of this webinar looks at the ways in which we use CT as a tool during the planning of surgical procedures. This can be as simple as providing a greater appreciation of the anatomy of an unfamiliar region, or the appreciation of distribution of fragments in a complex fracture, such as this highly comminuted condylar fracture in a cat. In this case, the CT allowed it to be established that the humeral condyle was simply separated into two parts, with severe comminution of the supracondylar region. It was then possible to first reconstruct the condyle using the principles of rigid internal fixation of articular fractures by applying a transcondylar lag screw, A biological osteosynthesis approach was taken to the supracondylar region, though, with application of bilateral bridging plates, realigning the bone and joint surfaces without attempting to reconstruct the bone fragments precisely. The cat went on to have good bone healing and a mild reduction in range of motion of the elbow and an intermittent mild weight-bearing lameness. In other situations, precise measurements can be made from the CT scan so that implants can be accurately positioned. In cases of humeral intracondylar fissure, formerly known as incomplete ossification of the humeral condyle, the optimal placement of a transcondylar screw can be calculated by positioning the planned drill line on a multiplanar reconstruction of the elbow, as shown in the top row of pictures. The location of entry and exit points for the screw are then calculated relative to medial lateral epicondyles, which are palpable during surgery. The entry and exit points are shown as blue dots on the three-dimensional reconstructions in the second row of pictures. The yellow and black striped areas are the safe areas for the screw to exit the bone. This demonstrates the small margin of error for this surgery. By doing this CT planning, the surgeon can significantly increase the accuracy of surgery, reducing the risks of screw entry into the joint, and reducing the chances of screw loosening and reducing surgical time. Another useful application of CT planning is for the placement of sacroiliac screws in animals with sacroiliac luxation or in cases with sacral fractures, as demonstrated in this case shown. Firstly, the optimum position of the sacroiliac leg screw is plotted on a multiplanar reconstruction of the pelvis. The optimum position maximizes the screw purchase in the bone and minimizes the risk of exit from the sacral bone. The location of screw entry and exit points are then plotted on a three-dimensional rendering of the pelvis and measurements made relative to easily identified landmarks, which can be found at surgery. In this case, the fracture was reduced and the reduction maintained using bone reduction forceps across the sacroiliac joints and an arthrodesis wire across the reduced lumbar sacral facet joint. A drill hole was then made using a C-guide across the sacroiliac joints before placing the transcondylar screw. Here we see the resulting screw placement. This guided technique is especially useful for animals with transitional vertebrae or abnormal sacral anatomy, where textbook recommendations for the placement of screws are not applicable. This is a good alternative to the use of fluoroscopy, which can be logistically difficult, is not widely available, and reduces exposure of theatre staff to ionising radiation. The assessment of animals with angular limb deformities is easier and more accurate using CT compared to planning from radiographs. The accuracy of planning performed using radiography is limited by difficulties in getting views of the affected limb, which are exactly orthogonal, and by the inability to assess torsional and rotational deformity using radiography. Using CT, angles can be measured accurately from images in orthogonal planes, eliminating positioning error, which occur during the acquisition of radiographs. The measurement of torsional deformity can be performed with ease using CT. This reduces the likelihood of unanticipated rotational deformities following the correction of frontal and sagittal plane deformities. Assessment of elbow incongruency is an important aspect of the assessment of angular limb deformity, since both issues may need to be addressed simultaneously. This 7-month-old golden retriever was presented for the assessment of a carpal valgus deformity and a 3 out of 5 left forelimb lameness. The angular deformity was found to be the result of an asymmetrical closure of the distal radial growth plate following a fall. This had led to a shortened radius, carpal valgus, carpal incongruency, and severe radial ulna incongruency of the elbow. Often, the angular limb deformity is the obvious issue for which the animal is presented. But as in this case, the elbow incongruency may be a more significant cause of lameness. This case was treated by performing a distal radial angular correction and shortening the proximal ulna by 4 mm to correct the incongruency. CT is extremely useful for the preoperative assessment of cases of medial patellar luxation. facilitating the selection of the best combination of surgical techniques to achieve success. It is most useful in identifying cases which are likely to suffer recurrent luxation following standard surgery. These include animals with marked angular limb deformities, such as excessive distal femoral varus. This Labrador shown had bilateral grade 3 medial patella luxation, bilateral cranial cruciate ligament ruptures, and 15 degrees of distal femoral varus, as measured in the image. This was successfully resolved with a distal femoral ostectomy, a transposed tibial plateau leveling osteotomy, block recession trochleoplasty, and lateral retinacular imbrication. Other angular deformities leading to medial patella luxation, including external torsion of the femur, tibial torsion, and tibial varus, can be objectively measured using CT. Other contributing factors, such as trochlear groove depth, the proximo-distal position of the patella, the rotational stability of the stifle, and the presence of concurrent cranial cruciate ligament instability, can also be assessed. An exciting and developing field of orthopaedic surgery is the use of CT images and 3D printed models to rehearse complex surgery. This can either be a virtual rehearsal performed on a computer, or as a physical rehearsal by 3D printing of bone models. Virtual rehearsal is performed using computer-aided design software. This allows different osteotomy patterns to be trialled and then reduced, with the introduction of torsion and translation where needed to get the best possible result prior to going to surgery. It can also allow the trialling of different implant options and the assessment of the bone stock available and optimum size and insertion angle for screws. However, using the technique does require considerable training and practice to get the most out of computer-assisted design software. The surgery can be made more accurate by the design and use of bespoke cutting and reduction guides. This antebrachial deformity in a miniature dachshund was causing him to regularly buckle over during walks and was resulting in a progressive left forelimb lameness. This posed us a number of challenges due to the very small size of the bones and the complex deformity present. Virtual rehearsal and computer-aided design was performed by Bill Oxley of Vet3D and used to produce cutting and reduction guides. The image on the left shows how the guide fits onto the bone and is secured with two arthrodesis wires proximal and distal to the osteotomy. The bone is then cut along the flat cutting guide. Just point that out. So it's not there. These are the cutting guides. So you cut along the flat planar surface of the guide there. And then there's the other one over there. So yes, the bone is then cut along the flat cutting guide, leaving two arthrodesis wires in each bone fragment. A second reduction guide, shown in the right-hand picture, is then fitted over the arthrodesis wires, which reduces the osteotomy and holds it in position whilst implants are applied. By applying this technique, it was possible to avoid a lot of the potential pitfalls of angular limb deformity correction, such as unintended rotational and translational deformities. If a physical rehearsal of the surgery is desired, the CT images can be processed to create a three-dimensional surface rendering of the bone, which can be imported into 3D printer software. The bone is then printed out in plastic. This gives the surgeon a physical model of the bone, which can be cut with a saw and have implants attached. This not only provides a unique appreciation of the precise abnormality present, but also allows the surgery to be rehearsed. This allows pre-contouring of the plate, as demonstrated in this toy poodle with recurrent shoulder luxation, which was treated with an arthrodesis of the shoulder joint. Here we see the plan put into practice with a good outcome. Rehearsal also allows the precise measurements of the screws, especially useful around joints, improves the precision of the surgical outcome, reducing surgical time and complications. In this way, it is possible to reduce the amount by which the surgical implementation deviates from the plan and moves much of the surgical decision making and contouring of implants out of theatre. This means that it is performed with less pressure and more opportunity to correct mistakes. Finally, CT has provided us with a valuable research tool to study orthopaedic disease. The sensitivity of CT allows it to be used in epidemiological studies, looking at the prevalence of conditions such as humeral intracondylar fissure, allowing orthopaedic surgeons to provide more objective advice to owners. The accurate measurement of limb alignment parameters has provided a better understanding of the pathogenesis of diseases such as medial patella luxation, as well as a tool for measuring the alignment of individual animals. It can also allow assessment of the safe corridors for implant placement in narrow anatomical corridors such as the humeral condyle and regions of the spine. CT has also been used to assess the effects of various surgical techniques such as dynamic proximal arm osteotomy on forelimb alignment and elbow incongruency, giving us more objective measurements with which to assess new and established techniques. I will leave you with this lovely CT image of a shoulder OCD lesion in a 9-month-old border collie, showing the changes in subchondral bone density around the lesion and the arthroscopic appearance of the flap. In summary, computed tomography has revolutionized the diagnosis and planning of orthopaedic surgery in the last 10 years. Through the increased accuracy of diagnosis achieved, we can proceed to treatment with more confidence. By allowing more in-depth preoperative planning and surgical rehearsal, it has allowed us to reduce surgical times and improve outcomes for our patients. Finally, insights are being gained into the epidemiology and pathogenesis of disease thanks to the ability to sensitively detect disease and make accurate measurements of anatomical parameters. Thank you very much for listening.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Duncan for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.